Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canon, chapter 14. King Chitraketu's Lamentation, text 7. Atrana sanseo bhuyad shroktam kotu halam prabho sapodu shena samare sasraksham atoshayat. Translation. My dear Lord, Shukadeva Goswami, although Vritrasura was a sinful demon, he showed the prowess of a most exalted Kshatriya and satisfied Lord Indra in battle. How could such a demon be a great devotee of Lord Krishna? These contradictions have caused me great doubt, and they have made me eager to hear of this from you. Sri Sukta Goswami said, after hearing Maharaj Pritchett's very intelligent question, Shukadeva Goswami, the most powerful sage, began answering his disciple with great affection. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, O King, I shall speak to you the same history I have heard from the mouths of Vyasadeva, Narada, and Devala. Please listen with attention. O King Pritchett, in the province of Shurasena, there was a king named Chitraketu who ruled the entire earth. During his reign, the earth produced all the necessities for life. Purport. Here, the most significant statement is that the earth completely produced all the necessities of life during the time of King Chitraketu. As stated in the Isha Upanishad, Ishavasham idam saravam yat kincha jagatyam jagat tena chaktena bhunjata madhrida kashyasvidhanam. Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. Krishna, the Supreme Controller, has created a material world which is completely perfect and free from scarcity. The Lord supplies the necessities of all living entities. These necessities come from the earth, and thus the earth is the source of supply. When there is a good ruler, that source produces the necessities of life abundantly. However, when there is not such a good ruler, there will be scarcity. This is the significance of the word kamadhuk. Elsewhere in Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said, kamam bhavarsha parijanya sarva kama jagamhi. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the clouds showered all the water that people needed, and the earth produced all necessities of men in profusion. We have experienced that in some seasons the rains produce abundance, and in other seasons, there is scarcity. We have no control over the earth's productiveness, for it is naturally under the full control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By his order, the Lord can make the earth produce sufficiently or insufficiently. If a pious king rules the earth according to the Shastric injunctions, there will naturally be regular rainfall and sufficient produce to provide for all men. There will be no question of exploitation, for everyone will have enough. Black marketeering and other corrupt dealings will then automatically stop. Simply ruling the land cannot solve man's problems unless the leader has spiritual capabilities. He must be like Maharaj Yudhisthira, Pritchett Maharaj, or Ramchandra. Then all the inhabitants of the land will be extremely happy. Om Vijnana Trimadandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militangena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasani Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama. Pritchett Maharaj has a doubt. Now, what does it mean to have a doubt? Elsewhere in Bhagavatam, in the third canto, you read that to doubt is a sign of intelligence. So naturally, the human intellect is inquisitive and wants to turn things over, around, upside down. And naturally, the intelligent human being doesn't simply accept anything that someone says. So what role does doubt have in bhakti? Indeed, we find in the section of Lord Kapila Day's teachings in the third canto, the statement to doubt is a sign of intelligence. But how far do you take that symptom of intelligence? How far do you take those doubts? The Vedic methodology is that doubting is fine until you are, until you have encountered an authority. After you have encountered an authority, whimsical doubting or sustained doubting is not intelligent. In other words, the authority resolves everything. Now, people today may feel uncomfortable with that. What do you mean the authority resolves everything? I resolve everything. But who are you? Your senses are so limited. Your experience is so limited. Even for ordinary material things, you rely on authorities. So why is it that when it comes to the most inconceivable things, suddenly you rebel against relying upon authority? You see, what's really underneath this syndrome is our refusal to accept our dependency. No one likes to be dependent in the material world for long. You may, for a few moments, like dependent. Oh, I just want to rest on you. I remember one devotee telling me, I just want to let go of the steering wheel of my life for a while and let someone else put their hands on the wheel and drive the car. So sometimes we get fatigued in pushing on our life and you just dream, someone else will steer my car for me. I can take my hands off the steering wheel for a change and just enjoy, of course, enjoy someone else driving my car. Enjoying the feelings of dependency. Just like little children relish depending on good parents. The father comes home from work, and the little child makes the father's day so worthwhile by running up to the father, and climbing on the father's lap, and the father feels, oh, this living entity is dependent on me. I feel significant. I feel my life has purpose. My life has meaning. Just think, to have someone rest their head on your shoulder and say, I can't make it in this world without you. Particularly the male ego just takes off. Yes. Don't worry. I'll carry you through all problems by my grace. So, for a few moments, human beings like to be dependent. But in the hustle and bustle of the daily world, dependency is considered a great weakness. In the job market, at the university, the pressure is on you to achieve, to compete. Dependency is considered a very inferior way of life. Whether you're a man or a woman, young or old, you have to carry your weight and get what's due for you and more. When we analyze our aversion to spiritual authority, it's because we don't want to acknowledge our dependency. We don't want to see how every aspect of our material life involves dependence. Information, goals, relationships. We're so tiny we can't get it together on our own as independent entities. In other words, in material life, independence is simply a wishful thought. That's all. Of course, the illusory energy tells you, you can be your own person. You can be your own man, be your own woman. Find your thing in life. That's the most important achievement. Find your way, your thing. So, the material world offers you false rewards for this false independence. And in this way, you forget how actually, as a tiny particle of Krishna, you are always dependent. Simply, you can choose either to depend on the illusory energy or depend on Krishna's spiritual energy. So Krishna's request in Bhagavad Gita is simply that you properly depend, since you have to depend anyway. Once we understand how truly helpless we are, then we can actually make progress in life. When we actually understand how dependent and helpless we are, we cry out for proper spiritual knowledge, proper spiritual guidance. So when you have doubts, yet you are in contact with a qualified spiritual guide, a qualified spiritual authority, then simply to have doubts makes no sense, because you have the opportunity to question. And because you are in touch with a proper spiritual authority, you're depending on a proper spiritual authority, you have the process for resolving the doubts. So in other words, why carry it on and on and on and on? The only way you would do that is if you have some big problem. Just like once, I'll give you an example. There were some devotees in Los Angeles in the 70s. And they decided that they had a better way how to spread Krishna consciousness. They left the ashram, they grew their hair long, they were wearing regular clothes all the time, and they were urging other devotees, "What are you doing in the ashram, you know? People aren't impressed by that. Just get out into the world and show your prowess. That's what will attract people to bhakti." So this went on and on. Of course, the old managers were feeling very threatened. So then Prabhupada came. And so these devotees, they came to see Prabhupada. And they were telling Srila Prabhupada, "You know, some of the things in your books, people are just not going to accept. Some of the statements are so inconceivable that these statements are barriers to the spreading of Krishna consciousness." They were telling Srila Prabhupada that. "There are things in the books that scientists will never accept." So Prabhupada was very gracious the things, statements in the books of science is never accept. "Okay, then don't worry about them. My books are not for them." In other words, he's just trying to give them a way out. "Okay, don't worry about it. It's not for them." Then he went on, "Blah, blah, blah, Prabhupada. This, Prabhupada, that." Basically, they're expressing their doubts, but they were challenging. In other words, their attitude was, "We know better." They went on and on like this, bringing up so many points.
tried to critique the Krishna book.
Nice book, Srila Prabhupada, but some of the statements in there, it's not good for people to assimilate what is bhakti. It's too far over their heads and too inconceivable. We're going on and on like that. Ladies going out preaching, ladies doing outreach. No, they should be home. They should just be minding the home. They had their own idea about everything. And Prabhupada began to humbly just say, look, I'm just following the order of my guru. That's all I'm doing. But they still wouldn't get the hint. They just went on about Prabhupada, yeah, but this should be corrected, that should be corrected.
I'm just following the order of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. What can be done?
But, on and on. Finally, they stop and they look at the problem. And now, we'd like to ask you for advice about what we should do.
And Prabhupada said, what should you do? Make money and enjoy.
No, Prabhupada, we meant what to do about our Krishna consciousness.
Krishna consciousness? Forget it.
The only instance that we know of where Prabhupada told someone to forget about being Krishna conscious. So their doubts were presented in their own way. They had a challenging spirit, very unsubmissive. Their whole presentation was, we know better, and we're going to help you, Srila Prabhupada, to correct some things that need to be adjusted. Now look at Pritchett Maharaj. He's presenting a doubt to Shukadeva Goswami. Of course, the questions of Pritchett Maharaj are asked on behalf of the audience. Still, you can take it that he's showing you the correct way how to express doubts. Just look. First of all, Prabhu, my Lord, Shukadeva Goswami. I got an issue here with what I've just heard. Vritrasura was a sinful demon. Yet, in battle, he showed the abilities of the most exalted Kshatriya warrior. Even Lord Indra was satisfied by Vritrasura's battle. Now, but I want to know, how could such a demon be a great devotee of Lord Krishna? Earlier in the chapter, Pritchett Maharaj had explained, the qualities of a demon covered by passion and ignorance, sinful. How is it that Vritrasura attained such exalted love, such exalted bhakti? You see, this is what captures a devotee's attention. Exalted devotion, exalted bhakti. This is what we love to celebrate. Rather than be envious about other devotees, we celebrate their exalted devotional service. We celebrate their devotional achievements. This is the wealth in our life, manifestations of exalted devotional service, exalted love for Krishna. In the material world, you don't like to glorify others. Or you only glorify others hoping they're going to glorify you. In the material world, when you do glorify others, all the time you're thinking, well, actually, I'm better. Like at the workplace, in the corporate world, on team sports, you're told to cheer the other players, the fellow workers, but it's just external. There's no heartfelt appreciation, generally. It's just, well, this is what you're supposed to do to get ahead. You've got to show the higher management that you're a team player. So you do that kind of show business. But devotees, a real devotee, is genuinely happy to see the exalted service of others. So just see the attitude of Pritchett Maharaj. I'm amazed. Such exalted love this Vritrasura showed. Yet he's a demon. You know what that means, Shukadeva Goswami? Passion and ignorance. Sinful activity, and the results of sinful activity. Yeah, look. You see, after the death of Vritrasura, Indra was not happy. Everyone else was happy. The demigods were rejoicing, Vritrasura is dead. But Indra knew this was a great devotee. And because he was a great devotee, that meant Vritrasura was actually a Brahmana. So I have killed a great devotee and a Brahmana. So this really, this understanding very much affected Indra. You remember how Vritrasura left this world. He knew that he was destined to be killed by Indra. And then he knew he'll go back to Godhead. So he was always in battle. He was always urging Indra onward. Come on, kill me. Come on, what are you hesitating for? He even once knocked Indra's weapon from his hand. And it looked like Indra was going to lose. So Vritrasura was urging Indra, come on, pick up your weapon. Come on at me. Come on. Now, why was Vritrasura doing that? Yes, as a Kshatriya, that's the way Kshatriyas are. But he had deeper knowledge. He knew that indeed Indra was going to kill him and that he would go back to Godhead. So he's saying, come on, Indra, give me. I'm ready to go back to Godhead. You're supposed to kill me. Come on. So he would encourage Indra, pick up your weapon, come at me again, come on. At the same time, of course, Vritrasura was fighting vigorously. So what was Indra thinking? Indra was thinking, what kind of demon is this? This demon is actually greater than me. He's actually a devotee. Vritrasura told Indra, look, you kill me and you win the battle. You win you regain your dominance in the heavenly planets. So yes, you get victory, but actually you lose. You get to stay in the material world and I go back to Godhead. So come on, kill me! In other words, Vritrasura totally redefined victory and loss. Yes, you're going to win, but actually you lose. From the material point of view, you win. From the spiritual point of view, you lose. You get to stay in the heavenly planets and enjoy. It seems like a victory, but it's all temporary. I go back to Godhead, where everything is eternal. So come on and kill me. What are you hesitating for? Do your best. Come on, I'm ready. So Indra was amazed by this. What kind of person am I dealing with here? So, after Indra killed him, the demigods, as we said, were celebrating. Vritrasura is dead. But Indra felt very bad. Such a great devotee. What have I done? So now in this chapter, Pritchett Maharaj, hearing this whole history from Shukadeva Goswami, is remarking, what was the history of this Vritrasura? I mean, he's just not an ordinary person, and certainly he's not a demon. Although, externally it seems he's a sinful demon. What's going on? How could it be that such a great devotee came out of such a demoniac nature, demoniac body? So Pritchett Maharaj is saying, these contradictions have caused me great doubt. He's being honest. But look who he's talking to. He's talking to Shukadeva Goswami, so he's rightly positioned to resolve his doubts. He's not just doubting willy-nilly, you know, just uncontrolled. Oh, I doubt this, I doubt that. Who knows? No one knows. I don't know, you don't know. Who knows? It's a modern life. No one really knows. And if anyone says they know,
You can understand, they don't know.
I hear this all the time. No one knows. I said, oh, really? You have that knowledge, huh? You have that knowledge that no one knows. Amazing. Sometimes people say that, you know, Bhagavad Gita, I've got a problem with that book. It's just too definitive. It's just too clear. Spiritual things can't be clear. Spiritual things should be murky and mysterious. Bhagavad Gita is just too precise. That shows it's not spiritual. So look at Richard Maharaj. He is expressing himself to Sukadeva Goswami. These contradictions have caused me great doubt, and they have made me eager to hear of this from you. Not that I'm just going to go on doubting. No, I have doubts. I'm eager to hear from you how to resolve those doubts. Because you know what you're talking about. That eagerness to hear, that is a necessary ingredient for development in bhakti. The materialist has eagerness to engage in material activities, to achieve material goals, and the Krishna Bhakta is eager to hear about Krishna. That's always a good sign of your spiritual health, when you have that eagerness to hear about Krishna, the eagerness to glorify Krishna. In the world of Maya, the non-devotees, you know, they have their exhortations. Let's do it! And in the bhakti world, we have our exhortations also. Let's hear about Krishna. Let's glorify Krishna. Let's do it. So in both worlds, there's dedication. Let's do it. But what the Krishna Bhakta does and what the materialist does are completely two different things. Although they could look the same, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, only a wise person can tell the difference between action and inaction. So Richard Maharaj is showing you that heartfelt investment in hearing. I'm ready to hear. I'm eager to hear. Obviously, he's fixed in attention, ready to hear from Sukadeva Goswami. So then we hear Sukadeva Goswami's response. Sutta Goswami is explaining all this. After hearing Maharaj Pritchett's very intelligent question, Sukadeva Goswami, the most powerful sage, began answering his disciple with great affection. So you see, it's not that bhakti is devoid of good feelings for others. In the beginning, there may be this misunderstanding that because there's no love in the material world, you have to be rough and tough with devotees. Sometimes, the men especially have this problem. Okay, reject any kind of affection, reject any kind of tender dealings, it's all rough, tough. The battle to go back to Godhead. But there is affection in bhakti. It is not mundane affection. Sukadeva Goswami is answering his disciple Richard Maharaj with great affection. So the affection in bhakti is in relation to Krishna and Krishna's service. As the disciple matures, the spiritual master is able to reveal more and more the intimacy of bhakti, not material intimacy, but the intimacy of bhakti. Just like in the section of the Bhagavatam about Dhruva Maharaj going back to Godhead, Dhruva Maharaj was concerned, where's my mother? I'm on the Vaikuntha aircraft, leaving this material world, going back to God. What about my mother? She was the one who pointed me in the right direction, telling me to go to the forest to find Vishnu. What about my mother? And so the Vishnu Dutas told her, just look around. Your mother is coming in another Vaikuntha aircraft. So Prabhupada writes in the purport, with utter exemplary, real bhakti humility. Similarly, he said, I'm just praying and hoping that I will have a powerful disciple who will take my feeble self back to Godhead. Is he just saying that? No. That's the depths of the feeling of a real devotee. So that is the kind of intimacy that develops in the guru-disciple relationship. As the years of dedicated service by the disciple go by. In other words, bhakti, affection, and intimacy is not cheap. It's in another realm, beyond physical and psychological affection. So therefore, it may take some time for this to be seen in the guru-disciple relationship, because it's not cheap. Everything is service-based. That's true of all the relationships in bhakti. Relationships between devotees, family relationships between devotees, relationship between disciple and guru, it's all service-based. Therefore, the affection can be real because the supreme real is in the center of it all. So indeed, Shukadeva Goswami began answering his disciple with great affection. And immediately he shows you he's genuine, he's bona fide. Why is that? He says, I shall speak to you the same history I heard from the mouths of Vyasadeva, Narada, and Devala. Please listen with attention. You know, Krishna stresses parampara in Bhagavad Gita. Evam parampara. Pratam imam raja seyavidu. This knowledge of the Gita comes down through the chain of disciple succession. And that's how the saintly kings will understand it. Because Bhagavad Gita is not just some book that you read in solitude in a cave somewhere. Certainly you can do that, and certainly a matter. But we should also understand that Bhagavad Gita is meant for the government heads so that they can protect the citizens from material illusion, material desires. So Krishna said that. I spoke this Gita to the chief living entity of the sun planet. That lets you know that Krishna doesn't have an ordinary body. Otherwise, how could Krishna be on the sun planet without burning up? So when he says, I spoke to Vivaswan, the chief living entity of the sun planet, he's also letting you know, I've got the kind of body that's not affected by the sun planet. What kind of body do you have? And of course, Krishna's explanation of his body goes beyond that. In other words, he doesn't simply have a special material body that can survive the sun. No, a Jopi son of the Atma, he has a body that's not different from himself. It's unborn, never deteriorates, inexhaustible. So just as Krishna speaks in parampara, so does Krishna's devotee. So immediately Shukadeva Goswami, in answering the doubts of Prishna Maharaj, presents himself as a link in the parampara by his saying, I'm going to tell you the same history I heard from this one, that one, that one, that one. And he lists those persons who are totally not ordinary persons. That means that what Shukadeva Goswami is going to relay is not ordinary. As soon as you hear from an ordinary person, don't expect anything out of the ordinary. Therefore, you hear from an ordinary person of this world, you'll simply hear about economic expansion, sense gratification. At best, you'll hear how to be religious so you can be a nice person. to be known as a nice person. But you'll never hear how to love Krishna purely. And that is what Srimad Bhagavatam is all about. What is the beauty of Srimad Bhagavatam? The beauty of Srimad Bhagavatam is that it doesn't allow anything else except pure love of Krishna. Nothing else. That's the beauty of Bhagavatam. So next, Shukadeva Goswami is going to start giving the history of Chitraketu. How he ruled the entire earth, and there was no problem with the earth producing the necessities of life. So this is bhakti environmentalism, bhakti ecology. If the heads of state have spiritual capabilities, then the earth will reciprocate. If not, the earth withholds. Chitraketu, by his ruling according to the advice of the Brahmanas, was able to govern in such a way that the earth completely reciprocated. There was no scarcity. There was no question of persons lacking their basic needs. Now, how are you going to present that to a political leader today? Well, what is my behavior? What does my political party have to do with how nature is reciprocating? There's no connection, absolutely. Here in Australia, you can tell that to the Labour Party and the Liberal Party. By the way, yes, Sydney is having one of the driest summers in history. We like that because it's great for going outdoors. Of course, one of these days we're going to realize that no rain means some problems. But anyway, it's good for sentient gratification. Every day you can go to the beach, and you can walk around practically unclad. And there may be a few problems down the road in that there's no water, for crops. But that's another thing. Don't worry, the scientists will solve it all. We'll make big desalination plants where we take salt water and purify the salt water of the salt so it becomes drinking water. Of course, what powers the desalination plants? Well, we need oil. How about nuclear energy? All these great gifts of modern science. So the problems just get compounded. Where Shukadeva Goswami gets right to the point. Look, what are the spiritual capabilities of your leaders? Obviously, Shukadeva Goswami is not worried about what political party your leaders come from. He's looking at the spiritual abilities. And therefore, Prabhupada is explaining, following from Prabhupada's explaining, that simply if the head of state, the government leaders, are properly situated in their spiritual consciousness, then they'll be able to actually give protection to the people. Nature will reciprocate. There'll be no scarcity. Okay, now we're going to go to Chitraketu. Not simply his government, which was perfect, but his personal life. This is the material world. And that means there's always some material problem somewhere, somehow. In terms of his government regime, that was expert. No hunger problems, no nature problems. But he himself had a personal problem. He couldn't have any children. Indeed, he couldn't have a son. He married one woman after another. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that it's not that Chitraketu married one woman after another because of enjoying spirit, because of passion. Another. This one will be better. This will be better sense enjoyment than this one. Look at that one. Beautiful. It's got to be mine. So that was not his mentality. He simply wanted a son. And each wife he married couldn't produce any children, but speak of a son. So this disturbed him so much. Now, you have to understand, to get the full impact of the situation, how Chichiketu had everything going for him. He was beautiful. He was youthful. He was born in a high family. His education was erudite. He was wealthy. He had all these things, but the way material nature works, there's always something missing. And that something missing drives you crazy. We can see that in our devotee community. When you look at other devotees who have what you want, oh, that Grihastha couple has so much of this. But then they don't have something else. Oh, they're very beautiful. But they have no money. Well, they have money, but they're not very beautiful. Oh, they have money, but they're not happy with each other. They're happy with each other, but they don't have money. They're happy with each other, and they have money, but they have no children. Oh, they're happy with each other, they have money, and their children are completely crazy. There's always something. This is a world where you can't have it all. Simply you can dream you're going to have it all. It's all going to work out. But at some point in everyone's life in the material world, you have to learn how to tolerate there will be some sector of your life that just doesn't work out. So just look at Chitraketu's example. Sukadeva Swami explains, in spite of being endowed with all these assets, he was full of anxiety because he did not have a son. And it's not only that Chitraketu was so beautiful and extraordinarily qualified, so were his wives. In other words, he was marrying one wife after another, but it's not like he was scraping the bottom of the barrel. All his wives were... Shall we? They were very attractive, we'll just leave it at that. Equipped with all Vedic qualities. Isn't that what the men dream of? She's going to be submissive. She'll be my Vedic queen. She'll wait on me hand and foot. She'll be around when I want her around and not be around when I don't want her around. And what do the ladies dream? He'll know what I'm feeling even before I feel it. He will work a full-time job and bring home lots of money. At the same time, he's going to chant all his rounds before he goes to work. And he's going to read Bhagavatam 2 hours when he comes home from work and talk to me for 4 hours. It all fits. So, Chitraketu had it all, except the son. So tomorrow we're going to hear how this is driving him crazy. He couldn't manage his way out of this problem. No matter how many women he married, the same problem was there. In other words, this was his destiny. Often devotees ask the question, how do you know when something is just the way it's supposed to be? You can't fight it. That's why bhakti requires guidance. At some point, after trying this way, trying that way, you realize this is not meant to be. I cannot adjust my way to happiness. At some point, tamsatikshasvabharata. At some point, you just have to tolerate. Even someone like Chitraketu, who had everything, almost everything, there was a major problem that was driving him to depression.
So that teaches you something about the world. This is not a world that's meant to fulfill all your desires. It's a world that's meant to promise you fulfillment and never deliver. So you might say, well, I were just a cave to it. I had all that wealth, beauty, education. I had all those beautiful queens. So what? I didn't have a son. But it's easy for you to say. But when you're in the position of someone else, with their desires, with their karma, your situation changes. It always looks easy to look at someone else. Well, if I had what you had, Prabhu, I wouldn't be complaining. The grass always looks greener on the other side. But you're not that other Prabhu with his or her complexities, desires, karmic burden you're carrying from lifetimes. So one of the things that make for exemplary devotee qualities is that you're able to walk a few kilometers in someone else's shoes and feel their life as it feels to them. And this way you can actually sympathize with Chitraketu. You may not see it the way he sees it, but you're not him. He was totally depressed. And we'll hear more about that tomorrow. You might say, that's because you don't have a kid. Look, you got the money. You got look at all these beautiful wives. You got power, opulence. All right, you don't have a kid. Big deal. But first of all, as a father, he wanted a child, especially he wanted a son. And secondly, he understood that to properly perform dharma, he needed a son who would perform yajnas after the father is gone, in case the father goes to the hellish planets, or in case any of the ancestors went to the hellish planets, the son would be able to perform yajnas to release the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather from hellish situations. Not that Chitraketu was doing any sinful activity, but at the same time, as a proper dharmic king, he wanted all the bases covered, you know? I've got the yajnas, I've got a son who's going to do yajnas in case I slipped up and went to the hellish planets. That's the vision of a civilized human being. He was concerned, what will my future be? So according to the Vedic standard, household life should produce a son. I remember, this is a story Yadubar Prabhu told me personally. It's not hearsay, but so many Prabhupada says that they increase exponentially every year after Prabhupada's departure. But Yadubar Prabhu told me directly this happened. He said that Prabhupada was speaking to dear departed God sister Yamuna Devi and some other Matajis. And they were in a situation in which their marriages had broken up. There was divorce. And so they were coming to Prabhupada for advice. And Prabhupada was obviously soothing them. He said, look, in your marriages, there's no children involved. So therefore, no children were born. So that, in other words, and he quoted some statement by Chanaka Pandit, household life without children is barren like a desert, so you don't have to grieve so much. Because what's the point of household life if there are no children? And you ladies didn't have any children, you're married, so it's not the greatest disaster. Because Vedic family life means having children. Chanaka Pandit has said, without children it's like a desert. So, at the time, Yadubar Prabhu and his wife Vishakha Manji, they were traveling with Prabhupada for doing photography. And, of course, they're always traveling with Prabhupada, didn't have any children. So Yadubar heard this from Yamuna, and he said, oh, wow, is my family life like a desert? Prabhupada said,
No children. We're missing the point of a family life. So he decided to go ask Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, I just heard that, you know, family life without children is barren like a desert, and that Chanaka Pandit has said such and such, and no problem, you know, what about Vishaka and I? Prabhupada just looked at him and said, Chanaka Pandit? Really? I said that yesterday, that family life without children is barren. Oh, I said that. That's for ordinary people. That's for ordinary people. Make Krishna your son. So they're different angles. I'm not saying, of course, one way or another, that's not my department, but just to show you, they're different angles. So Yadu Bhagavan was said for quite some time. In fact, he didn't have any children until after Prabhupada's departure, because they wanted to just travel with Prabhupada and engage fully in devotional service. So they have different angles, that's my point. But Chitraketu, he didn't take it that way. Chitraketu was just devastated. No son, no son. I married woman after woman after woman. What's going on? So, in this situation, Angira Rishi, the mental son of Brahma, born from Brahma's mind, is going to wander in. And so tomorrow we'll hear about how Angira Rishi handles the situation of Chitraketu's depression. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.